The Song of Solomon, chapter 6, continues this really very painful attempted romance between Solomon and this Egyptian girl. And it's not a happy series of love songs here in the Song of Solomon. It's all about tension, and the tension and stress and anger and fear that arises from illicit relationships. There's a big tension between the lover, the Egyptian girl, and the daughters of Jerusalem. And they mock her in verse 1 of Song of Solomon 6. "Where has your beloved gone, you fairest among women?" I think this is bitter sarcasm. "Where has your beloved turned aside?" And they use the phrase for turning aside to other gods, which is, of course, what Solomon did as a result of his relationship with these sort of women. And they're mocking her, "You who are the fairest among women." In other words, he thinks that you're the prettiest of all of us. How mistaken you are. And she replies, in a very catty sort of way, verse 3, "I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine." In other words, no, he is solely mine. And, she must have been, she had the blindness that comes from love and so forth, that she thinks that he's only got the hots for her. Not at all. He, of course, tries to comfort her in verse 4. He then says, "Yes, you are beautiful, my love, as Tirzah, lovely as Jerusalem." So he's saying that I see you as if you are a Hebrew girl. Whereas we've seen earlier in chapter 3 that she longs to drag him back to her mother's house in Egypt and to live with him there in Egypt. She doesn't like it in Jerusalem, but he says, "Oh, you're as beautiful as Jerusalem." So he is seeing her as if she is a Hebrew girl. And quite often in the descriptions of her, he says that you look like various features of the geography of Israel. "You, the Egyptian, I see as a Hebrew girl. I see you as an Israelite." Well, you could argue that this is all an allegory and this talks about how Jesus imputes righteousness to the Gentiles. Well, maybe that line of interpretation doesn't really grab me. I think that, quite simply, we've got a window here into the psychology of marriage out of the faith, into the psychology of falling in love with an image of a person rather than the person itself, which is a far more practical, I think, teaching. So he likes to see her as if she is Jerusalem, when in fact she only wants to get him back to her mum's place in Egypt, according to chapter 3. He says, verse 5, "Turn away your eyes from me, they've overcome me. Your hair is like a flock of goats along the sides of Gilead." Again, likening her to a feature within Israel. But the way he talks about how he's so attracted and bowled over by her eyes, well, he had this relationship when he was a young man, and it was when he was a young man that God gave him the wisdom that he wrote down in the book of Proverbs. And he says there in Proverbs 6:25, "Keep away from the Gentile woman, don't lust after her beauty in your heart, neither let her captivate you with her eyelids." But she did on his own admission. This Gentile girl captivated him with her eyelids. And he says openly in chapter 4 that she has stolen his heart. And yet he warns, "Don't let her captivate or steal you with her eyelids." So you see there how somebody can know something, can know truth, but not personalize it. And this is a challenge to all of us, that what we know about God, about Jesus, about the coming of the kingdom of God on earth, this is not simply to be left as knowledge. This is to be believed in and trusted in personally, that this shall be true for little me. And when you personalize it, that is when you have really believed. Until then, it's all knowledge. And we can assume too easily that because I know something, I therefore believe it. And that is a totally wrong assumption. You can know things, and yet they don't personally register with you. Whenever we read the miserable story of Samson and Delilah, you know what's going to happen. And you think, Samson, come on, don't you see she keeps on asking you where your strength lies? And you're getting closer and closer to telling her the truth. And when you tell her, she's going to betray you yet again. Don't you see this, Samson? Oh, yes, of course he did. But then he didn't. And you see this in human life so many times. People remain in terribly abusive relationships, clinging on to a certain idea they have about the other person, wishing to interpret the most obvious bad facts in a good light and so forth. And this is how, unfortunately, we are wired with this tendency. I would say it only that strongly, with this tendency to know things on one level and yet totally not believe them on another. And when it comes to the gospel and the good news of God's love, I think that is the parade example, that you can know that Christ died for my sins according to the scriptures, but not believe it. If you believe it, then you say with Paul, Galatians 2:20, the Son of God loved me and gave himself for me. And then you personalize it. So, of course, he's got quite a hard job. He's got to persuade this girl that actually she is unique for him. He says in verse 8, there are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number, but you, verse 9, my dove, my perfect one, is unique. I mean, what kind of fool is going to believe him? But she believes him, apparently. I suggest that at the time, this is now early on in his reign, he had 60 queens and 80 concubines plus virgins without number. And later that was to go up to 700 queens and 300 concubines. So at this point, he's got 60 queens and 80 concubines. And yet out of all them, he says, yeah, I've got all them, but you're the one. And she kind of believes it. And this is, as I say, I think an insight into relationships gone wrong. And it's a window onto the psychology of people in those relationships. He, as I say, sees her as if she is an Israelite. She desperately wants him to go back down there to Egypt and into her mother's house, etc. She's in conflict with the daughters of Jerusalem, but he tries to kid her that, no, you're my unique one. Don't worry about all the other women I got in my life. You're the special one. And she wants to believe it because she loves him. And, you know, we see this kind of thing going on in dumb relationships, just no hope of relationships all over the place. And I think the point of the Song of Solomon is really how it finishes, that it doesn't finish how you would expect the classic romance to finish, with the wedding and so forth, and bearing children and living happily ever after. It doesn't finish like that. It finishes with the two splitting up. Well, maybe they did get together later, got it together, but the point of the Song of Solomon is that this kind of relationship does not satisfy. And in the end, it ends in tears and grief on both sides. And that is, I think, the point of the final scenes in chapter 8.